The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. A lot that we want to try to get through on today's program. Quite a few more articles on the deep state and some really fascinating sound bites as well. And the reason we want to just dig into this yet again is because of how many commentators are now saying just how close the United States came to, well, losing its foundation, becoming unmoored as far as its constitutional foundation is concerned. And so we'll get into that and review some of the events from the past week or so, and also look just at some of the history from the past couple of years. And in the weeks ahead too, we're going to focus in more on this this critical transition period, the very end, the tail end of the Obama administration, and then carrying on through to the Trump inauguration in January of 2017. So we'll come to that just in a little bit. And also in the concluding segment today, we'll be looking back at some of the warnings from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. It was on this day 100 years ago that this celebrated author was born. He was quite the commentator later in his life, and he gave, as my father wrote about in the 1990s, he gave a strong warning to the United States back in the 1970s, I believe, with a speech that he gave at Harvard. Solzhenitsyn, he died, I think, about 10 years ago, but as I say, today, December 11th, this is the 100-year anniversary of his birth, so this is as good a time as any to look back at some of the things that my father has written about Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Well, today was supposed to be a big day right here in the UK. This was the day we were supposed to have the vote on Brexit. And Theresa May, of course, has spent the last few weeks trying to sell her deal with the EU, trying to sell the people of Britain on this deal. A really, really bad deal, to use the language that Netanyahu often does, or did with the Iran nuclear deal. But this was the day it was supposed to be voted on in Parliament, and it was looking very much like it was going to be voted down, and that Miss May might even, that she probably would have had to resign because of this. And so she's delayed the vote, and she announced this decision, I think, just yesterday. And so now she continues, I guess, going to Europe to try to get better terms, terms that the people of Britain will approve of. I think she has one change in particular, hoping to get rid of the backstop, the so-called backstop arrangement through Northern Ireland, which would basically move Britain out of the EU, but still keep it subservient to European rules and laws. And that's what a lot of people in Britain don't want. Well, that's going on here in the UK and in Europe. Lots of leaders there are saying, we're not going to renegotiate this. You're not going to get any better terms. Jean-Claude Juncker, he said, I think just yesterday, that there's no room whatsoever for renegotiation. He said the deal we have achieved is the best deal and the only deal possible. The Irish Prime Minister, he came along as well, saying that the deal could not be renegotiated. So there's lots of anger building in the UK. As I said on yesterday's show, you see a lot of anger building all across the continent, all across Europe. And Mrs. May is, she's adamant that it's all going to work out, that there will be a deal of some kind. The The Telegraph, this is Alison Pearson at The Telegraph, she said after two crawling years of Brexit negotiations, a damning poll at the weekend revealed that half of all voters think that British politics is broken, and only one in seven believes that that Tories and Labour represent the views of the public. There's just a growing dissatisfaction with government, period. That's what this article is saying. She says, meanwhile, the PM's personal ratings have sunk so low, they've been seen in Perth. Perth, Australia, I guess she means. What will those same alienated voters make of a cabinet that cancels a crucial vote to save its own skin while claiming to be acting in the national interest? It's just like Macron in France. Why, we're doing what's good for the country. And the country is upset. They're not taking to the streets yet here in the UK. In fact, Melanie Phillips says that's just not the way we do things. But here in Britain, to just draw a contrast with Britain and France, and of course we don't know if that's the way it will always be, but there's a lot of unhappy people. That's the point of Alison Pearson's piece. And it's a similar point in Melanie Phillips' piece at the Times yesterday. She explained how that this deal is so unpopular with voters. And she writes, this is at the conclusion of Melanie Phillips' piece, unlike the French, thankfully the British don't go in for political violence. Their anger, however, now threatens to undo the compact inherent in representative democracy between governing class and governed. It says the 17th century civil war was about parliament against the crown. We are facing the prospect of parliament against the people. If MPs don't enable Britain to leave the EU next March, they risk provoking a constitutional crisis, the likes of which this country has never seen. And so, again, think back. The ominous potentialities, as Herbert Armstrong wrote about, in 1973, he basically said that joining the EU back then would tear the nation apart, the UK. And that's what we see happening. So much turmoil. Last night you had the French president on his nationally televised address. He's already bowing to the protesters. Now he's on TV, profusely apologizing, promising handouts for everyone, trying to calm down the general public. The Times said this about President Macron's speech. A contrite President Macron raised the minimum wage last night and unveiled a series of concessions in a 10 billion euro spending spree aimed at ending a month of violent protests that battered his administration. This has gone on now for weeks, a month now. And so here he is, handing out 10 billion euro worth of concessions, thinking that, well, this will surely satisfy the mobs. It says in a solemn television address, Mr. Macron said that he had understood the anger of the Yellow Vests movement, which was justified in many respects. That's what Macron said. You're justified in all these violent acts. It says he admitted that in his rush to reform France, he had upset people. Without doubt, this is quoting him, without doubt, we have not managed to provide an answer. I accept my share of responsibility, he said. I know that I have managed to wound some of you with my statements. And so he's adding a hundred euro a month to the minimum wage, and then some of these other perks and such, things that France really can't afford. So they've gone from tacking on this tax, this carbon tax, to pay for all of these climate change costs, and now they've had to remove that tax and then give handouts to try to just to try to please the people, to try to buy off the protesters, basically. And France's national debt, it's even higher than it is here in the UK. So in the long run, this is there are no good options here. This is not going to work out well for France. It's not working out well for the UK. It's ongoing Brexit negotiations. Well, we can get into that more. We'll have to. We'll have to keep our eyes on it. Because like I said yesterday, you're just not going to get that. In the United States, most in America, they're just drifting into a deep sleep. Consumed by politics. Not that that isn't a story. As I said at the top of the show, there are prophetic implications here. You go back to the start of this year. I think my father gave a sermon in March. I believe it was March 17th. Where he talked about God temporarily saving America from the radical left. And so when you see some of this lawlessness unveiled, when you see this lawlessness unmasked, it is significant from a prophetic standpoint. Last week, Kimberly Strassel, we quote from her a fair bit. She writes at the Wall Street Journal and I think for Fox News on occasion. But she goes back and plugs in some important dates that just triggered this nonstop investigation. And as I said yesterday, the latest proof for sure that he's going to be impeached, or that he's going to be indicted, or that he's going to be in prison, that he's going to be in jail, a campaign finance violation. That's where we are, 2 years in. Strassel, in her piece, she takes us back to General Flynn and how that the deep state went after him even before Donald Trump was inaugurated. She says on January 2, 2017, the Obama White House learned about Mr. Flynn's conversations with Mr. Kislyak. That's the Russian ambassador. So he was talking with a Russian. He was talking with a Russian. Just two, three weeks before the inauguration. And they caught this, the deep state, they caught this conversation. It says the U.S. monitors phone calls of foreign officials, but under law, they are supposed to minimize the names of any American caught up in such eavesdropping. In the Flynn case, someone in the prior administration either failed to minimize or purposely unmasked Mr. Flynn. The latter could itself be a felony. So Strassel, she's being pretty nice about it, because we know what was going on, don't we? We know all of these illegal acts that were going on, purposefully unmasking, in this case, General Flynn. And then if that wasn't bad enough, it says here, 10 days later, someone in that administration, the Obama administration, leaked to the Washington Post that Mr. Flynn had called Mr. Kislyak on December 29th, 2016, on February 9th. So they leaked that to the Washington Post. I think it was January 12, 2017. Then it says on February 9, 2017, someone leaked to the Post and the New York Times highly detailed and classified information about the Flynn-Kislyak conversation. So they not only unmasked General Flynn, and then leaked that to the Washington Post, the fact that he had this conversation. Then, less than a month later, they revealed the details of this conversation. The top secret details of this conversation between this Russian ambassador and the incoming, the National Security Advisor, I think he was slated to be. He was in that position for all of a month, I believe, before the Trump administration let him go. But here they are revealing this highly detailed and classified information about the Flynn-Kislyak conversation. It's all out there, New York Times, that Washington Post. Strassel says here, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes has called this leak the most destructive to national security that he has seen in his time in Washington. Nothing worse than this, according to Devin Nunes. It says, disclosing classified information is a felony punishable by up to 10 years in federal prison. The Post has bragged that its story was sourced by 9 separate officials. 9. They could find 9 people in the deep state to say, oh yeah, that's what they did. That's what they discussed. That's what they talked about on the phone. It was put out in the public. Strassel says the Mueller team has justified its legal wanderings into money laundering. Paul Manafort, and then campaign contributions, Michael Cohen, on grounds that it has an obligation. This is the Mueller team. It has an obligation to follow up on any evidence of crime. So that's how they're excusing this latitude. It's not just Russian collusion. Look, in the course of this investigation, if we find other felonious acts, we've got to follow up on them. No matter how disconnected from its Russia mandate, and Strassel says Mr. Flynn's being caught up in the probe is related to a glaring potential crime of disclosing classified material. Yet, Mr. Mueller appears to have undertaken no investigation of that. So you see how selective the prosecuting is. Here is, as Devin Nunez said, the worst leak he has ever seen in Washington. The worst leak. And the Mueller team, utterly, utterly unconcerned about that. That's a felony with penalty of up to 10 years in prison. But whoever did that, and it wasn't just one, was it? The Post, it bragged about its story, the fact that it was sourced by 9 separate officials in the deep state. They're very confident. Oh, yes, they're reporting spot on all of these leaks, even top secret, even classified information. No investigation into that. Strassel says, is this selective justice or something worse? Well, I'll answer that for her. It's something worse. It is. She says in her piece, she's exposing all of this lawless behavior that not only goes after the Trump administration, but it provides cover for Obama, as she titled her piece. It's Mueller's gift to Obama. Plenty of gifts to go around for the Obama team, for the Obama administration, for all of the Obama people in the deep state. Strassel, she explains in her piece how that they went after Flynn initially. They justified it by saying that he could be violating the Logan Act. In fact, when Mueller recommended his sentence for Flynn last week, the beginning of last week, he said, look, he's been a pretty good man. He's had all this this history and in the military and such. And so I would recommend that he not have a prison sentence following this, because we caught him in a lie, because we caught him in a misstatement. They trapped him, in other words. But it all got started because he supposedly violated the Logan Act, a 1799 statute that's only had 2 defendants, I think, ever charged, and no one ever prosecuted. She explains how normal, how common it is for a presidential transition team to talk to their foreign counterparts. They don't just start the day of inauguration totally blind. There's a transition team. They prepare the way so that the president can hit the ground running. Obama's team did it. The Bush team did it. Oh, they all do it. This is common, but they used this obscure statute to go after Flynn first, because their ultimate target is Donald Trump. And so they were saying, after the stunning defeat on election night, don't you jump the gun, you Trump people. We've got one president. That's Barack Obama. He's president until January 20th. And so they justified this investigation into Flynn because of this obscure act. And that was even mentioned, as I say, in that that sentencing admonition that Mueller gave to the court just last week. She says here, it's hard to overstate how unserious the Logan Act claim is. If Mr. Mueller has no case to make that Mr. Flynn violated the Logan Act, he has no business bringing it up. So they just keep bringing it up, but in the end, they didn't actually follow through and do anything with it. The reason, though, that they keep bringing it up is because this was the pretext for all of this nonsense, for all of these investigations, of course, that culminated in the Mueller team itself and all of his left-wing prosecutors. All that they can see is unlawful behavior in Trump officials. That's it. They're totally blind to illegal unmasking or illegal leaking. They're totally blind to those felonies. It says here, the Mueller team in its document praises Mr. Flynn's exemplary military and public service, but concluded that senior government leaders, this is from that document last week, we've read this before, but Strassel says, but concluded that senior government leaders should nonetheless be held to the highest standards. And Strassel concludes by saying, if only Mr. Mueller believed that applied to all public officials, including Obama Democrats. And so they continue on, covering their own tracks, even as they try to expose any and everything about every official connected to Donald Trump. James Comey had that closed-door session on Friday before the two House committees. And as you've probably seen, over and again, time and again, he said, I don't know. I can't remember. John Solomon at the Hill said he didn't seem to know that his own FBI was using number 4 Justice Department official Bruce Orr as a conduit to keep collecting intelligence from Christopher Steele after the British intel operative was fired by the Bureau for leaking and lying. In fact, Comey didn't seem to remember knowing that Steele had been terminated, according to sources in the room. His memory was so bad, I feared he might not remember how to get out of the room after the interview, one lawmaker said. Another one lamented, it was like he suddenly developed dementia or Alzheimer's after conveniently remembering enough facts to sell his book. He makes the millions off the book and the talk show circuit. All of these details. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Donald Trump said to me, he said this to me in private. And I'm here to reveal it to the world. Now he's called to testify. Under oath, I presume. And he can't remember. It was something like 250 times. He said, I don't recall. I can't remember. Conferring with his lawyers time and time again. This is a common tactic from the radical left. You saw it with the case of Kavanaugh. Here comes the woman. Oh, yes, he did this to me. I can't. It's seared in my mind. And then, like the president rightly pointed out, she couldn't remember anything else. Where it was, when it was, who was there, what room it was in, how she got there, how she left. Can't remember all of those details. But just coming forward with this this scurrilous accusation. It says here in Solomon's piece, the towering ex-FBI boss confessed that the FBI had not corroborated much of the Steele dossier before it was submitted as evidence to a secret court to support a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. A warrant to spy, in other words. That was one tidbit that came out of that hearing on Friday. Is that he did admit that dossier was never verified, and that's what they used to get all those warrants to spy. That's how it all came together. Solomon says Comey now has confirmed what Republican lawmakers like Devin Nunes, Charles Grassley, Mark Meadows, and Jim Jordan have warned about for months that the FBI used an unverified dossier. Listen to this. They used an unverified dossier paid for by presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party as political opposition research to justify spying on the duly nominated GOP candidate for president just weeks before Election Day. And so we're supposed to believe that the only thing that the Mueller team can find here that's really egregious is a loan application or a campaign finance violation? It says, let's remember, well, it just makes another point about Comey saying that FBI agents don't give a hoot about politics. He said that a year or so ago. And then you might have heard him over the weekend saying that we've got to use every last breath that we have to try to stop Donald Trump. He's not political, though. Never was when he was the FBI chief. In fact, it's all politics. 250 times? I don't know. I can't remember. Conrad Black, he has a piece at National Review. I can probably skip through some of this, but to get on with our sound bites. But Newt Gingrich, he was at Fox yesterday, just talking about this unbelievable number of I can't remembers. He said this yesterday, clip one.
I mean, the very people who lied to the court, they're not facing any consequence. You know, if Comey had been a witness being interviewed by Mueller, and he'd had 245 I can't remembers, I suspect they would keep him in there for 1,000 hours until he finally remembered. This is nonsense. Any person with a reasonable sense of judgment knows that they were breaking the law for the purpose of trying to defeat Donald Trump. And then when the Trump won anyway, they went on breaking the law, including illegally leaking things. And this is, it's hard, as a historian, it's hard to explain how unique it is to have the head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation this deeply engaged, this dishonest, this patently fraudulent. I mean, nobody believes he didn't know 245 times. And I think that it is a really sad commentary on how sick the system has gotten.
That's Newt Gingrich on Fox News last night. A sad commentary on just how sick this system of justice really and truly is. Victor Davis Hanson, he had a piece at American Greatness where he talked about, okay, so they discovered that Cohen is a shady figure, but it takes 18 months and $40 million to turn this up, to figure out that he didn't pay all of his taxes, or to get him to flip, to get him to conflict with a previous statement that he made, or contradict what he had said previously, to now say, yeah, there was a campaign violation and Donald Trump was a part of it. That's what $40 million gets? That's what a never-ending investigation turns up? And Hanson points out all of these advisors working for Clinton, Vernon Jordan, some of the deals that he worked to keep Monica Lewinsky at the time in the 1990s from ever seeing the light of day. Of course, that story eventually came out, as we all know. But here again, things that just go on routinely. Presidential assistants who are told, just look, take care of this problem, make it go away or whatever. Victor Hanson says here about Flynn, while being threatened with the Logan Act, Flynn allegedly did not recount his conversations in a way that matched transcripts of furtive surveillance of the Russian ambassador. Translated, that means Flynn was likely reversed targeted on the chance of catching him in a perjury trap. It says, in the old days, liberals would have argued that the warrant for such surveillance, originally based in part on a fictitious Steele dossier that created a sort of government hysteria to monitor all things Trump and Russian, contaminated all that followed as the fruit of a poisonous tree. And according to the exclusionary rule, Flynn would have never faced perjury charges had he not been reverse targeted for perfectly proper conversations with the Russian ambassador who was targeted for surveillance. Flynn may have been unmasked largely due to a mysterious last-minute Obama executive order vastly expanding government access to surveillance transcripts and in hope of guaranteeing that the names of those whom the Obama administration had spied on would be unmasked and leaked to the press. This is what we're going to delve into further in the weeks ahead, looking at that critical 40-day period. That transition period, here's the Obama administration changing all these laws, last-minute executive orders to ensure that people like Flynn would be unmasked and then leaked to the press. Felonies! To ensure that they could get away with felonies! Yes, indeed. Some dark history. Well, he goes on to explain how that everything was set up to trash Donald Trump. And he was going to lose, of course, because of this this insurance policy. And it was all going according to plan. It was working out perfectly. Right up until Donald Trump actually won. Right up until he shocked the world. Right up until he shocked the deep state. Hansen was on Mark Levin's program, his Sunday night program in the States there a few weeks back. I think this was in mid-November or something, but he's explaining here why Levin, I think, asked him initially. So you're one of the few scholars and historians that put your support behind Donald Trump early on. Why did you do that? And he explains why he supported Trump's candidacy. Here's clip two.
Trump seemed to be the only one that was unconcerned what the establishment, and by that I don't want to be vague, what university professors said, New York Times said, PBS, NPR, Council on Foreign Relations. He just spoke to the people, and he did it in such a way that was refreshing, and he sort of was psychodramatic that this was an existential war and we were losing it and we had to fight back and not be worried what people said.
And so he got behind him because Donald Trump is a fighter and he was prepared to fight back. He had some misgivings about it. Here's what he said, clip three.
I thought he was just eccentric and I was a little bit dangerous, I thought, but I thought that he was, at this point, we're at a point of no return, and he was the anecdote.
That's interesting there, what he said about being at the point of no return. Again, just how close we were to losing our country, to losing the Constitution. He went on to explain the reach, the far-reaching impact of the radical left in the United States. Here's what he said, clip four.
Say we're the typical of conservative America, you and I, the 65 million that voted for Trump. We look around, it's like a soon opticon. We've got the NFL, NBA, Silicon Valley, Apple, Google, Facebook. We've got Rockefeller. We've got the Brookings Institution. We have cable TV, not just MSNBC and CNN, but the major networks as well. We have NPR. We have PBS. We have the progressive cultural movement,
rap, academia. Music,
academia is where I am, and we're surrounded, and we think that these institutions don't have as much clout as they do have, and then we get shocked every 4 years that the message just surrounds us, and we don't have a mechanism for breaking through to the American people and getting a message. And the irony is the message of free market capitalism, limited government, individual liberty is what they thrive for. In their daily lives, they sometimes vote against their interests because this circular octopus, synopticon, whatever you want to call it, we don't get any. You and I, conservatives, traditionalists, we have safe spaces, if I could use their word, where we retreat to. For them, it's a 24/7 relentless entertainment, education, politics, media, and it's overwhelming.
It's overwhelming, and it's everywhere. It's a 24/7 thing, as he explained. And if it would have had Hillary Clinton carry on with Barack Obama's legacy, well, that was the point of no return, as Hansen said there. Now, you go back to what my father said earlier this year. As I say, it was a March 17th sermon where he talked about saving America temporarily, and then, of course, it reappeared as an article at thetrumpet.com or in the May 2018 Trumpet magazine, where he said the radical left, they were about to take over. And he also explained in that sermon from March that had that happened, it would have stifled this work, God's work, from going out, from getting our message out. My father said here, this is from the article, Donald Trump is a man with serious problems, but the radical left is relentlessly waging war against the president and leading this country to its destruction. And it was only Mr. Trump's election that prevented even worse troubles from bringing this nation down even more quickly. It was his election that prevented the collapse from happening sooner. And so isn't it amazing now, 6, 8, 10 months on from that, more and more commentators, as they look back on that time 2 years ago, are saying just how close we came to losing everything. Rush Limbaugh touched on this on his program just yesterday. Listen to some of these clips from his show. Here's clip 5.
The alternative to Donald Trump was unacceptable. Hillary Clinton, the continuation of the Obama agenda, and the dilution of the United States of America as a sovereign nation and a continuation of its becoming a member of a global conglomerate where there wouldn't be any debate about climate change, we would just pay up. Where there wouldn't be any debate about open borders, we would just keep them open. Where there wouldn't be any debate about whatever American culture or society is, it would be whatever the socialists said it was going to be.
That's from his program yesterday. My father, when that article came out, or here's what he said in it from May of this year, for 8 years under President Obama, the forces of the radical left were on the march, virtually unchecked. Even Republican leaders caved in, and that was after they had taken control of Congress and had a lot of power to stop the president, but they never did it. And this is what Limbaugh mentioned in his program yesterday. They never fought him. They never stood up to Obama. They didn't have the will. They didn't have the backbone to fight. My father says Donald Trump has proved himself willing to take a stand where others have not. He said it's something to behold, him resisting these anti-American forces. He has inspired a few other leaders to challenge the radical left and to help expose it for what it is. He has inspired some others, not nearly enough, but some. Listen to what Limbaugh again said on yesterday's show, his show, clip 6.
And I even said, I don't know how many times I've said it, there is nobody I know, in or out of politics, who could put up with what Donald Trump puts up with and stay focused. I don't know anybody who wouldn't be reduced to tears at the loss of their reputation or why everybody hates them or why can't they just leave me alone? What did I do to these people? I can hear all the complaints. There's not a single person that could put up with what he's putting up with. And the fact that he's putting up with it to essentially save this country, we ought to be grateful. People ought to be grateful, but there are people.
That's pretty amazing that he's putting up with all of this to save this country. Now read second the last many verses of 2 Kings chapter 14 about that second Jeroboam the second Jeroboam who comes on the scene, I'll just read a couple of verses here for you. It says, "For the Lord saw the affliction of Israel," this is verse 26, "that it was very bitter, for there was not any shut up, nor any left, nor any helper for Israel." There just was nowhere to go. There's no help. There's no way out. It says, "And the Eternal said not that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them." He saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. God intervened to save Israel. He did it anciently, and he did it in this end time as well. The mercy and the love of God. The patience. It's only temporary. We can't get our hopes up. We can't be blinded to what's happening in the world. The United States, really, in so many ways, even with this temporary salvation, is just being ripped apart, ripped to shreds on the inside. None of these people that just want to go after them, no matter what, they're not thinking about what's best for the United States. Not at all. They're thinking about political gain. They're thinking about political war. That's all. They're in it for themselves. Here's this one man who puts up with so much to essentially save the country, to use Mr. Limbaugh's language. Notice further what he said. Here's clip 7.
The guy that sent me the note says, "You know, I get uncomfortable sometimes for a nanosecond with Trump's blasts. But mostly, his furor sometimes overshadows his great record, which has already bested both Bushes. But that's about 1% of my worries, given without him by October 2016, we were doomed for a disastrous 2009 to 2024 medieval age." So this guy literally believes that Trump's election staved off an absolute crisis and disaster that would have meant the end eventually of this country's founding. And therefore, keep in perspective why all these assaults and who's behind them. By the way, I have to say that I would venture to say that a significant portion of the official elected Republican population does not see it this way at all. You and I know this. This is why it's been so frustrating voting for Republicans, and they've said the right things on the campaign trail, but when it's come time to fight back or even just defend themselves, they haven't done so.
They didn't fight. Republicans he's talking about there. But before that, again, some astounding remarks there. He's commenting on, I guess, one of his friends that sent him a note. And he's commenting on that, this guy believing that the election of 2016, that it staved off an absolute crisis and disaster that would have meant the end, eventually, of this country's founding. You see more and more as time goes on, you see just how accurate, how prophetic those comments were earlier this year, at the start of the year. My father talking about that prophecy in 2 Kings 14 and verse 23 through 27. He said in the article, my father did, "It's critical that we realize why this resurgence. Why is it happening? Why did God do it?" It says God himself is pushing back against the Satan-inspired forces that would have destroyed this nation. One final clip here from Rush Limbaugh yesterday, clip 8.
Nothing has worked. They haven't, in their minds, they should have been rid of Trump in the first 3 months of his term. In fact, they should have, in their minds, he shouldn't have been elected. The stuff they threw at him, the Steele dossier, all that stuff, that should have prevented him from being elected. And he survived it, and he continues to survive this, defined by he's still there. And he's still getting up every day and going to work and attempting to advance his agenda.
It's something to behold, as my father said in that article. So there are, as much as people obsess over politics, when you step back and look at what is happening, what has happened in the last couple of years, the last 3 years or so, you can certainly see God's hand. We'll go back and look at that that article, Saving America, Saving America from the Radical Left, temporarily, as my father said, in the May issue of The Trumpet. When we come back, we'll spend what little time we have left talking about Alexander Solzhenitsyn and one of the warnings that he gave to our nations. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
The renowned Russian novelist and commentator Alexander Solzhenitsyn, he was born 100 years ago on this day. And as I said at the top of the show, I believe he died about 10 years ago. So he lived a long life and gave a very serious and sober warning to the United States back in 1978. And my father drew attention to this speech. I think it was at Harvard University. He drew attention to this speech in the July 1998 trumpet. So this trumpet goes back 20 years. Pretty amazing. The speech that shocked America and Britain, my father wrote. That was the title of the article, and then we reprinted that article, or much of it, 10 years later, in August of 2008, remembering Solzhenitsyn's warning. My father said here, his Harvard speech sent shockwaves throughout the West. Most politicians, educational institutions, and the media turned bitterly against him. They liked him before this speech, and then after that, they turned on him. Why? What did he say? It says in the Harvard speech, A World Split Apart, he showed that we are condemned by our own history. Our own history condemns us. He says here, my father does, the humanistic way of thinking, which had proclaimed itself our guide, did not admit the existence of intrinsic evil in man, nor did it see any task higher than the attainment of happiness on earth. It started modern Western civilization on the dangerous trend of worshiping man and his material needs. This is, I think, either paraphrasing or quoting from Solzhenitsyn himself. This trend in education, modern education, where the heart of man is good. If you go back to the program that we had on Friday, I think it was, we went through some of those verses in Jeremiah 17, if you remember, and how that, with respect to our founders, like John Adams and others, they understood well that the carnal man, the carnal mind of man, is innately evil, just as Jeremiah says there. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. I took you through those verses in the Gospels that talk about the sickness that's there and our need for a physician. My father says in his article, in early democracies, as in American democracy at the time of its birth, all individual human rights were granted on the ground that man is God's creature. That is, freedom was given to the individual conditionally in the assumption of his constant religious responsibility. 200 or even 50 years ago, it would have seemed quite impossible in America that an individual be granted boundless freedom with no purpose, simply for the satisfaction of his whims. Now, this is something that Solzhenitsyn touched on in 1978, 40 years ago, in his Harvard speech. And look at where we are today. We call for boundless freedom. Lawlessness, run amok. Except, of course, when it comes to your political enemy, then you hold their feet to the fire. You send them off to prison. You find some obscure statute that's never been used, and you go after them. Judges 21, verse 25, every man just doing what seems right in his own eyes. Solzhenitsyn said in that speech from 1978, he said, all the celebrated technological achievements of progress, including the conquest of outer space, do not redeem the 20th century's moral poverty, where no one could have imagined, even as late as the 19th century, no one could have imagined it this way. Moral poverty. We have all of this advancement. This is the paradox that Herbert Armstrong talked about. All of this advancement in technology, but no corresponding advance in morality, in purity. And so you look at those critical verses, Jeremiah 17:9, or verse 5 from that same chapter, we're cursed. If we put our trust in man with this kind of human heart, with this kind of deceitful wickedness on the inside, if we don't have God, if we don't have moral underpinnings based on the Bible, what do we have left? What do we have if we have boundless freedoms? Well, you have anarchy. You have anything goes. My father wrote, the defense of individual rights has reached such extremes as to make society as a whole defenseless against certain individuals. He's quoting Solzhenitsyn there. We defend individual rights at such extremes that we're defenseless now against certain individuals. Isn't that the truth? That was from a speech 40 years ago. Look at how it applies to today. As my father said with the original title of that article, this is a speech that should shock us. It says, this tilt, again, he's quoting from Solzhenitsyn's speech, this tilt of freedom toward evil has come about gradually, but it evidently stems from a humanistic and benevolent concept according to which man, the master of the world, does not bear any evil within himself. And all the defects of life are caused by misguided social systems, which must be therefore corrected. So it's all of these social systems. That's all the defects that you see in life and in society around. This is why we were at such a danger point. Like Victor Davis Hanson said, we were past the point of no return, or we very nearly got there. Were it not for the election of Donald Trump, someone who was willing to fight back, unlike even other Republicans. The people of his own party wouldn't do it. Further on, this is from Solzhenitsyn's speech. He says, hastiness and superficiality are the psychic disease of the 20th century, and more than anywhere else, this disease is reflected in the press. Such as it is, you can see why the press turned on him. They're sitting there listening to this speech. He says, such as it is, however, the press has become the greatest power within the Western countries, more powerful than the legislative power, the executive, and the judiciary. And one would then like to ask, by what law has it been elected, and to whom is it responsible? Who does the press report to? What are the laws that are governing the press? Can you see why they're so furious? They're so obsessed and deranged? Because someone would actually have the courage to call them out, to tell them that they're guilty, that they're printing lies, that they're enemies of the people. These are prescient remarks coming from someone who wasn't even an American. This great Russian novelist coming to the United States, coming to Harvard, and telling us what the problem was 40 years ago. And my father drew attention to it 20 years ago. And how much more so it applies, this warning, that should have shocked us, how much more so it applies to today. By what law has it been elected, and to whom is it responsible? He says, in the communist East, a journalist is frankly appointed as a state official, but who has granted Western journalists their power, for how long a time, and with what prerogatives? My father then connects that quote with Judges 21:25, which I mentioned a little bit ago. Every man doing what seems right in his own eyes. But think of it. Here's Solzhenitsyn saying that the greatest power in the nation today, it's not the White House, it's not the legislative body, it's not the judiciary, it's the press. It's the press. Who can argue with this sound advice? Or this warning, this prescient warning today? Well, there's a little bit more I could touch on. Perhaps I can save it for another day. That's all that we have time for on today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send any and all comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.